Thanks. And I'm at UC Davis, and since everyone's very confused about my affiliations always, since I'm kind of a physicist and I'm a little bit of a theoretical computer scientist, and I'm in the Department of Mechanical Engineering and a center, and I'm at the Santa Fe Institute as external faculty too, so I figure I'll just keep getting more affiliations so that none of it makes any sense. So this is the work that I'm going to talk about. It was on the cover, and it's joint work with Jennifer and Christian and Noam Berger, who's another organizer, and Bobby Kleinberg. So this is going to be part one of the talk. Is going to be looking at how preferential attachment can actually come out of a more fundamental underlying optimization model. And then part two of the talk was actually motivated by some of the discussion that I heard from the young people who were talking about how we haven't been talking about dynamics. And this was actually work that I did a couple years ago, where we were trying to understand separation of timescales. So we were looking at dynamics on graphs and trying to look at Markov chain properties, like mixing times and cover times, and trying to understand when we might have separation of timescales so that the random walker moved on a network much more quickly than the network changed. So that will be the second part of the talk. So the first part is looking at preferential attachment. And what I want to sort of motivate this by is thinking about data. Okay, so where would we see power laws in real-world data? So as we've seen, there's definitely this beautiful power law in the World Wide Web, goes on for orders of magnitude. And in a social network, certainly it's possible to have power laws going on for a while. If I told you that there were power laws in earthquake magnitude, absolutely, but there's definitely some cutoff at some length scale. And we might say, are there any power laws in the internet? And I think that obviously depends a lot on what level of the internet you're looking at and what you mean. But certainly, why would we think that the routers should have any kind of power law degree distribution? And basically, the point is that power laws have some limitations. They can't go on forever. There's finite size effects. There might be resource limitations. There might be some geometry. There's some underlying physical constraint that doesn't allow you to grow so large. And this distinction that I just wanted to make is that the internet is a physical geometric network, so the routers and the fiber optic cables have a location on the surface of the Earth, as opposed to the World Wide Web, which is a virtual application layer layered on top of those physical layer. So different constraints at those different levels. So we can ask this about power laws, and now let's ask the same question with preferential attachment. So if I told you there was preferential attachment in the growth of the World Wide Web, we've seen some mechanisms for how that might arise. So I see the popular pages, so I'm more likely to link to them. In a social network, that would also make sense. I want to be connected to the people who have a lot of connectivity. You know, if I was going to say preferential attachment drove the power laws in earthquakes, obviously that's not true. And on the internet, you know, why would preferential attachment drive power laws at the router level? And at the AS level, why would autonomous systems want to connect to each other just because they're popular? So we were trying to understand more of like an economic level of why ASs might connect to each other, other than just assuming preferential attachment.
I'm so sorry. Why do we say obviously not in earthquake magnitude?
That it's preferential attachment?
Because we don't want to prefer, because we prefer that that's not true?
Well, how
but would it, isn't so it the case that one earthquake can trigger another?
They can, but...
So wouldn't that be preferential attachment?
But it's not like... I guess that there's some chance that you could think of a preferential attachment model. But it's a more distributed system. But yeah, that's true. Okay, so I won't put. I'll remove the obviously. I'll say possibly. I'll put a question. I would say that there's a lot of geometric constraints that underlie why earthquake magnitudes happen.
Well, she doesn't question the power law. She just questions the mechanism.
The mechanism.
I'm aware of that. But
yeah. No, that's.
I
agree with you.
Something that can, if you look at the models that Langer and our former
Gene
with the sliding blocks and the friction,
there's this cascading event.
Absolutely.
You know, and you see that in the power grid too, cascading failure. So
and that
point
is
taken. Okay, so it's clearly I have to think about this a little more. And just as motivation, I wanted to put this up. And this is actually a nice piece of data that I got from two Hungarians, Balázs Szendrós and Gábor Znany, who was actually a classmate of mine in grad school, and they were studying the Who is Who network in Budapest. So here the nodes are individual people, and it was like a MySpace in Budapest. So it was run out of a coffee shop. And they had their friends make a web page, and they asked all of their friends' friends to log on and make a web page and connect to each other. So this is looking at the number of connections that people have, the probability of observing someone with K friends as a function of K, the number of friends. And actually, it's nice that I put this up here because this is one of the functions when they initially saw it. These two are physicists, and they came at it, and they fit it with two power laws. So they got this data, and they thought it was a two power law data set. And then they started talking more to statisticians and people like Aaron, who understand a lot about maximum likelihood fitting. And they did that, and they realized that there was a much better explanation for the data than the two power laws. And it was a power law followed with an exponential tail. And actually, this is what we see empirically, pretty ubiquitously. So when we first started looking at measurements, people saw a lot of heavy tail distributions and started fitting power laws. And in the last few years, there's been a lot more careful studies of this. And people have realized that a lot of those power laws are actually modified by exponential fit. So it's a power law in some regime with an exponential tail. So this is actually really nice work that came out in 2003 in Science by Geo and Bader et al, where they were looking at the protein interaction maps of Drosophila. And they found that it was a power law with an exponential tail. We are looking at gene flow hybridization in plants. Things like these two are physical, the earthquake magnitude and avalanche sizes of ferromagnetic materials. And then we see some things in co-author networks where they're very well fit by power laws with exponential tails. And so people in the last few years have been realizing that it's not really power laws, that this is a better description to the data. And they've often come up with models that have preferential attachment with saturation. So if you put these two mechanisms in a priori, you'll end up getting a power law with an exponential tail. So it's a nice fit to a large range of data. So real power laws are observed as well. So these are just some examples, popular web pages, city size ranks. Certainly, at critical points of phase transitions, you see a lot of nice power laws. This is actually a snapshot of component sizes of the Erdős-Rényi random graph at the critical point. And there's been some measurements, so I'll talk about this a little bit later, of the autonomous system level internet, where people have measured what appears to be like power laws, but we'll discuss that more. So there are power laws known, and there's some known mechanisms for them, so phase transitions, fragmentation. And one of the most well-known models is preferential attachment, which we've discussed many times. And so I've seen it attributed to Polya and to Yule so far in this conference. And so Polya came up with the EARN models, and Yule was a geneticist who was looking at preferential attachment to explain evolution of genetic diversity in plants. And then Ziff noticed the distribution of city sizes. And Simon was an economist who really sort of popularized this idea. So he came up with the term the rich get richer. And this is basically the concept that your growth rate is proportional to your current size. So the rich get richer. If we all put our money in the bank account and got the same rate of return, then the wealth that I have tomorrow, that we all have tomorrow, is proportional to how much we had today. And you start out with a random distribution, it all grows with that same exponential rate, and when you look at the end result, you end up with a beautiful power law degree distribution or wealth distribution. So Simon coined that term, the rich get richer. And actually, I don't think it's on here, but it's really interesting because if you go back to the sociology world, you realize that this is a sort of a paradigm that they've been using all along, and they call it the Matthew Edict, dating back to the book of Matthew in the Bible. So there's a quote in the Bible that says, "For he who hath shall be given." So they call this idea of preferential attachment the Matthew effect in sociology, well before Simon came around and said the rich get richer. So it's kind of a well-known phenomenon. And then Derek de la Sola Price was an information scientist, and he was looking at co-author citation networks, paper citation networks. And he came up with a model of network growth that was almost identical to Barabasi and Albert's model. And this is basically the idea. Okay, and so you put this growth rate in, and you look at a network growth model, and you'll end up getting a degree distribution that's a power law. And several people, so these two groups, Kathy Borner at Indiana et al., and Luis Amaral and Eugene Stanley and a few other people, they added in saturation. So they started out with preferential attachment, and they added in saturation, and they got an exponential decay and fit a lot of real-world data. So they take these two things as fundamental axioms. And there's certainly an alternate view to think about how power laws come about, and that was put forward by Mandelbrot at the same time that Simon was talking about the rich get richer. So Mandelbrot was thinking more about optimization, and his interest was in information theory of the statistical structure of language. So he said, what is the goal of language? It's to optimize the amount of information conveyed per unit transmission cost. So he came up with a nice, simple argument. He thought of an alphabet of D characters with N distinct words, and he ordered all the words by their possible lengths, and then the cost of the jth word ordered this way is the log base D of J. And then he looked at the average cost per word, so he just took the probability of the jth word occurring and summed up over the cost and came up with the average cost. And he used the information theoretic notion of the information per word. And then he said, what do we want to minimize? We want to find the probability distribution that minimizes the cost per information transmission. And when he minimizes this, he gets a power law degree distribution for the frequency of words in language. So he put forward the idea that optimization could give rise to power law degree distributions or power law distributions. And Mandelbrot and Simon had this very heated exchange for 3 years in this journal Information and Control, and they exchanged 6 letters back and forth. And they're very sort of entertaining letters to read because they really discredit one another and claim that the work that they were doing was more fundamental. And they never reach any resolution. They just have a lot of contention and arguments. And they were published in this journal, so they're totally accessible. They're all in Michael Hitzenmacher's review as well. So if you're interested in the history, Michael went through it very carefully and has all the citations. So back in the early 60s, there was this debate, optimization, preferential attachment, which one is correct. And the economists really liked the idea of the rich get richer. So it made a lot of sense from an economic point of view. So they took that idea and ran with it. And optimization really was on hold. So no one was really working on optimization for years. And as far as power laws go. And I think that Jean Carlson and John Doyle really brought forward this idea of optimization giving rise to power laws. Do you look on Henry?
I'm curious, do you know if Mandelbrot ever compared what he got from that to actual statistics in human language?
I don't know.
I mean, it's an awfully funny idea, right?
That,
no,
I think he did. That was his thesis, actually.
Oh, really?
That was his thesis.
It's an awfully funny idea because you really throw out all notion of redundancy for error correction in language. Anything close to correctness, really amazing.
A lot of his work that
yeah.
He throws out a lot, and he still manages
yeah,
to retain.
I've heard about this
to retain.
So the economists liked that idea, and optimization resurfaced like in '99 with Carlson and Doyle's work on highly optimized tolerance, where they showed that you could bring forth power laws from an underlying optimization, and they were looking at models of forest fires on lattices. And that was their original model that they looked at. And a couple of years later, 3 computer scientists, I'm going to explain their model to you because it's very nice. They took these ideas and applied it in a computer science context. And around the same time, Ricard Soleil was working on some things like this too. And this is the FKP model by Fabricant Kitsoukias and Papadimitriou. And ours is going to be sort of a variant on that. So I want to start out with this model because it's a little simpler to explain. So they're going to look at a network growth process on a unit square. So nodes arrive one at a time, and they have to connect to an already existing node. And we're going to start out with a single root node, and then the other nodes are going to arrive, and they have to decide who to connect to. And they're going to look at a cost function that I wrote here that's a linear combination of 2 metrics. So the first one is a spatial metric. So node I arrives, and it wants to connect to node J that minimizes this cost function. And d sub ij is the distance in space, Euclidean distance between I and J. And h sub j is going to be the hop count of node j to the root. So this guy is hop 1 away from the root, this guy is hop 2 away from the root, this guy is hop 3 away from the root. So you're going to look at all possible nodes, all the nodes that have existed before you arrived, and you're going to evaluate this function and choose the one who minimizes it and connect there. So it's a trade-off between Euclidean distance and network distance. So it's a beautiful model, and they did some analysis on it and thought that they had generated power law degree distributions. But when the proofs were examined in more detail by a few people in this room, and Bella Bolivash and Noam Berger.
And Alice and
yeah,
Oliver Weir.
And Oliver. Reardon. So when you do the proof in more detail, you find out that in the asymptotic limit, there are almost only leaves. And what happens is that the first sort of 1 over alpha nodes that land end up being condensers. So they end up being hubs, and everyone else connects to them as leaves. So they kind of partition off the phase space, and then they collect everyone else. So in the asymptotic limit, all the nodes are leaves. And what I just wanted to say was, I actually was simulating this before people had worked out the proofs, and I saw a big bimodal degree distribution. So I saw a lot of nodes that had low degree, and then I saw a hump out here of nodes of high degree. And I've sat in this very room several times where there were debates going on about whether the PDF or the CDF is the right one to look at. And I've sat through many discussions in this room about people advocating one or advocating the other. And I don't see why people just don't look at both, because it's really not that much more difficult. and it's very clear. So in the paper where they publish this, they had only looked at the CDF, and it hit that secondary bump. And by looking at the PDF, that secondary bump was very obvious from simulations. So I just wanted to say that, because I know that I've had that debate in here before. So it's a nice optimization model, but it ends up generating this bimodal distribution.
So is there a clear separation in some asymptotic limit between condensers and leaves?
Yes. And so you can prove that n minus little o of n vertices are leaves.
And then.
So they thought this was giving rise to power law, but what we said was that all but little o of one are leaves, so obviously there's no power law. It's all concentrated.
And I guess we didn't.
Do we have any idea what little o of one is?
We probably have estimates in our proofs, but I
don't
think.
No, but I mean, is there any chance that it's actually a finite number or not?
Well, you can kind of guess from this. I mean, when you go through the proof, you find that there are basically Voronoi cells of diameter 1 over alpha. There's a length scale in that system.
Yeah.
When you take a real distance metric, and you multiply it by a parameter, a physicist should realize that it's going to introduce a length scale. These were computer scientists. And so it was only in hindsight. We were trying to prove more detailed things about their proofs that we realized, well, their proofs weren't even correct.
No, I want
to. Okay. Yes.
A different question is that so here you have everybody attaching to the top count to the root. Why to just the root? Is there some motivation for why?
Yeah. So the root is sort of the central node in this network. So you want to have a short hop count to anyone else. So it's trying to minimize the diameter of the graph.
Okay.
So you want to connect to someone who's close to you in space, who gives you good network performance. So you want to have small hop count. You know, and obviously, what I'm going to talk about later is looking at information flow on network topologies, and stars might be really pathological, right? And this is trying to make you make a star. So good. And actually, there are two limits that we can think about, right? So if alpha is 0, then the only thing that matters is hop count, you make a star. If alpha is really huge, then the only thing that matters is Euclidean distance, and you make some kind of spanning tree. So we were motivated by this idea and started from that. And like FKP, we're going to consider linear trade-offs, but we're going to use a scale-free metric instead of a metric with a distance in there like alpha had. And what's going to be interesting is it's going to give us a local model. So in FKP, they had to evaluate every single node before they decided whom to connect to. And we're going to get something that's local. And we start with this optimization. And what was much more surprising than getting power laws is that we show that it gives rise to a mechanism of preferential attachment. And it also gives us saturation. So two things people had put in a priori to explain real-world data, and it pops out of this underlying optimization framework. And in addition to that, we get a new concept, which is viability. So not all nodes are born with the same attractiveness to gain new children. So it introduces some heterogeneity. So not all children are going to be equally fertile, just like not all spin-offs of companies are going to be equally fit, et cetera. So it gives us a potential mechanism to introduce heterogeneity into growing network graphs. So these first two things people have used already, and this might be a really interesting thing to pursue. So we can't even do a square. We're going to start out with a line. And we're going to think about the same idea that nodes arrive one at a time on the unit line, and there's going to be a root node at 0. And the nodes that arrive have to look at an optimization function to decide who to connect to. So this is the same idea as FKP, except instead of making alpha be a constant, we'll let it be some function that depends on the local information in that space. So the most natural thing was to make alpha proportional to the density. So if you land in a dense area, it's going to cost you more. If you land in a sparse area, it will cost you less. So we put this function equal to some constant, which I called alpha, times the density of nodes between T and J. Okay, and the density of nodes between T and J is the number divided by the distance. And now when I multiply this term by the distance, it just gives me the number. So what I care about now is the number of intervening nodes between me and my potential parent. So I want to connect to anyone, to the person who's going to minimize the number of intervening nodes and the hop count, the network distance. So let me see what the next slide says. Okay, so we're going to think of this as cost being proportional to local density, and it reduces to thinking of the number of points in the interval between nodes T and J. And we felt that this has some connections to thinking about how autonomous systems on the internet exist. So autonomous systems are like trusted domains where you use loose protocols. So like UCLA is an autonomous system. Walter, you can help me out. So Sprint and AS, or Sprint is a service provider, right?
Sprint is an ISP, and this memo is
AS. Okay. So an AS uses laxer routing protocols inside the AS, and to communicate with other ASs, they use more complicated protocols like BGP, Border Gateway Protocol. And when a new AS appears, it can send traffic to the people who are inside its AS, but to send it to other ASs, it has to make peering agreements in order to send traffic. So we think that this sort of sounds at a high level like what an AS has to do. It arrives, it wants to start up a business, and it has to make peering agreements to send its packets through different transit intervals, and it wants to minimize the number of transit intervals that its packet has to go through to reach its destination. Okay, so that's all I want to say about that. Okay, so here's just a simple process of how this, a simple illustration of how this process would work. Okay, so a new node arrives, it has to connect to the route. So nodes start arriving, they're evaluating whom to connect to. And it gets more interesting once more nodes are there. So when this node 4 arrives, it can connect to node 1, and it doesn't pay anything for the transit interval, but it pays 1 for the hop count of node 1. So to connect to node 1, it pays 4. Sorry, it pays 1. And if 4 wanted to connect to 0, it would have to pay 3 for each transit interval. So it pays for 3 transit intervals, each at cost alpha. So it pays 3 alpha, and there's no hop count of the route, so it ends up paying 3 alpha. So for this particular illustration, I said alpha is between a third and a half. So it's going to be advantageous to connect to this guy. It'll have lower cost. So in this particular illustration, 4 is going to connect to 1. Okay, and you'll notice that along the way, 1 suddenly became colored at time 3. So it was empty, and it became filled in with red at time 3. And why that happened is because node 1 suddenly became fertile at time 3. So I'll explain to you what that means in a minute, but I guess I should make a comment that this ends up being a local model, because you either connect next to you, to whoever's next to you in space, or to the parent of whoever's next to you. So all you need to know is who's the person in the interval next to you, who's the parent of that node, and how many intervening nodes are there. So that's the information that we need to do this. Okay, so node 1 became fertile at node 3, and this is what I wanted to illustrate. Okay, so if we define that alpha was our one parameter, and we define A as the integer, the ceiling of 1 over alpha, we find that a node must have A minus 1 transit intervals between it and its child before that child becomes fertile. So when there were less nodes between 0 and 1, it was more advantageous to connect to node 0, but once there are A minus 1 transit intervals between 0 and 1, it's more advantageous to connect to the guy who's closest to you. So node 1, after there are A minus 1 siblings of node 1 becomes fertile. So that's how these things start gaining differences in viability. Okay, and what we wanted to do, I told you about the process on the 1D line, and we were really interested in thinking of the network structure, so we wanted to map the line onto the resulting tree. So I just did the mapping here manually. Okay, and what we wanted to do, so what we did is we integrated out the dependence of the line length. So here, probability, the nodes land uniformly at random on the line between 0 and 1, And we want to integrate that out. So right now, if it's uniformly at random, the probability of landing in this interval depends on the length of the interval. And we're going to integrate out the dependence on the interval lengths. So now we just want to think about the probability of the next node at t plus 1 arriving and landing in the kth interval, conditioned on the distribution of the nodes, so the order of the nodes. And we integrate out the dependence on the line, and we find that the probability to land in any interval is uniform over all intervals. So we're kind of throwing dice in a funny way. So instead of normalizing that by the line, we're normalizing by intervals. Okay, and once we do that, we end up getting this idea of preferential attachment with the cutoff. So if we let d sub j of t equal the degree of a fertile node at j at time t, as nodes start arriving, each new child contributes another interval, and that contributes to the attractiveness of the parent. So when there are less than a children of the parent, each newly arriving node creates a new interval and contributes to the attractiveness of the parent. So initially, your attractiveness grows in proportion to how many children you have. And then once you have a children, all the new intervals go to your children. So you saturate at that level. So the probability of the t plus first node attaching to node j is now equal to the maximum of its degree, or a, divided by some normalization, which is just the total degree. So if it didn't have this, if it was just the d sub j, if it was proportional to d sub j, that would be regular preferential attachment. And now we get preferential attachment with a cutoff. So that's how preferential attachment emerges from this underlying 1D optimization problem.
Can you just remind me again
yep.
what capital A is?
Capital A is, so alpha was our parameter. And capital A is 1 over alpha. Okay, and it's the integer. Yeah, and it's the integer because we didn't want it to be a fraction, because you can't have fractional children. Okay, so this is what our process looks like. Nodes start arriving, they have timestamps, and then they can have a stamp about when they became fertile. And what we thought about was what Sid showed us, the master equation approach, and I'm just going to show you how that would work briefly. And we want to think about the process on the degree sequence. So let n sub 0 of t be the number of infertile nodes at time t, n sub k will be the number of fertile nodes of degree k, and we're going to look for nodes between degrees 1 and a. And we'll let n sub a of t be all the fertile vertices, so we're going to lump them into the tail, because they've saturated, so they don't really add a lot of difference to the equations. So if we look at, I didn't write out the distribution. So this is looking at the probabilities. So instead of looking at the numbers, I'm going to divide the number of nodes by the total number of nodes and get the probabilities. And I can look at the rate at which nodes of degree 1 become nodes of degree 2, the rates at which nodes of degree k become nodes of degree k plus 1. And I'm sorry, I should have written out the sequence, the degree sequence in simple terms, but I didn't. But essentially, we know that these guys nodes of degree k can become nodes of degree a with a certain rate, and nodes of degree 1 become nodes of degree 2. So I should have written out these recursion relations in detail. But what I did write out was in terms of their probabilities. So it's showing the rates at which nodes of a certain degree become nodes of a higher degree. And we know that I didn't put the nodes of degree 0 on here. And there were two hard things for our proof. And we had to show the convergence to a stationary distribution. So we had to show that eventually these probabilities became independent of time. And once we did that, we got some simple relations for showing the flow of the probabilities. So this is actually looking at the flow of the probabilities. And then we had to show concentration. And that was actually mostly the technical details were done by Noam. And he used this backward random walk. So it might be interesting to ask him some questions about that. And once we do that, we show concentration and steady state. Then the mean field equation, that master equation that we wrote, is actually a good description of our process. So we showed that the average description that the recursion relations give us actually matches a realization. So this is the recursion relation that we get. We get a probability of seeing nodes of degree k are related to nodes of degree k minus 1 and nodes of degree k. And this is for nodes of degree between 1 and a. And this is what the recursion relation we get for nodes between 1 and a. And when we actually work that out, you can find that we get a power law degree distribution with -2 for nodes of degree less than A. And then for nodes of degree greater than A, we get a second recursion relation. And when you multiply that out, you find that you get an exponential cutoff. So this is our degree sequence, is that we get a power law degree distribution with power law 2 up until A, and above A, we get an exponential tail. So we get a power law, but it only has one value, it's 2. And our tail is set by that parameter alpha or A, either way. So it's kind of nice, we can describe one class of power laws, but we were really interested in trying to think about how to generalize this model. And there's actually two different processes going on. Okay, so new nodes are arriving, and they keep attaching to things, and eventually you're gonna saturate at some parameter, which we call A. But there's two processes, because as soon as you saturate, it also means that your children are born viable. So there are two things that happen at that saturation point. Your children are born viable, and your probability of gaining attachment saturates. So there are two independent processes, so we decided to generalize it and make them two different parameters. So now we have the viability threshold, so once there are A1 siblings, you become fertile. And the attractiveness threshold, which your parent now saturates at a different parameter, A2. So it was a simple generalization of our model to a two-parameter one. And we can, all the proofs go through, they're a little bit more complicated, but we get the same kind of Markov evolution of our system. And there's some interesting limits, because if A1 is 1, so all children are born fertile, and A2 is infinite, so you never saturate, you get the normal preferential attachment model. If A1 is 1, so everyone's born fertile, and A2 is finite, you get a preferential attachment with a cutoff. If A1 equals A2 equals 1, you get the uniform random graph growth process. So we can contain this family of other models in our two-parameter one. And what we also looked at was that with the two-parameter model, we get a power law up until that saturation point, and we get above that saturation point exponential decay. And now our power gamma is a function of A1 and A2. And the exponential decay parameter is set by the saturation level, A2. So we have gamma, which is now a function and is tunable. And you can show monotonicity. So you can show that gamma is bounded between 1 and 3, and it decreases monotonically with A1 and it increases monotonically with A2. So we can now get any power law between 1 and 3 by doing this more complicated two-parameter model. And what's interesting is that people have been observing power laws in so many different realms, and most of the technological exponents, so for the internet, for things like the internet, the power laws tend to be between 2 and 3, but in a lot of biological systems, the power laws tend to be between 1 and 2, and no one really had models for getting parameters less than 2 before. So a preferential attachment gives you gamma equals 3. You can do a mixture of preferential attachment and uniform attachment, and you can get gamma greater than 2. But we now have a way of getting gamma less than 2, so we can get between 1 and 3 with this more complicated two-parameter model. And again, I just wanted to show all this data where people have done more careful measurements, and they find these power laws. And most of them, you can see there's a couple that are actually less than 1. So this one's 0.5, and this one's 3/4. But most of them are actually kind of small. They're 1.2, 1.3, 1.3. So they were out of the realm of what those normal preferential attachment models had given us. And one of the things that we were interested in was trying to fit some data that we could find. And we were very interested in thinking about the AS level topology, because we had this mechanism that sounded a bit like setting up hearing agreements. So you want to minimize transit intervals and have good network connectivity. So we were very interested in looking at the AS level topology. And there was a really beautiful piece of work done by CADA, the Center for the Cooperative Association for Internet Data Analysis at UC San Diego. And they put forward two nice papers in the last couple years where they looked at three standard views of the internet. It's called Three Standard Views and One Definitive Metric. And they look at the three views they look at are based on trace routes, so following the paths of individual packets, from BGP tables, so looking at border gateway protocols, so the border protocols that ASs use to exchange data with each other. And then they looked at this other data set called WHOIS, which is actually entered in manually by service providers. So the engineers running the ASs maintain these tables manually. So there's a lot of problems with that since they're manually maintained, but they found some data from a European system, RIPE, which they deemed to be very high quality. So they chose that particular incarnation. Okay, and the first two views, traceroute and BGP tables, have shown to give power law degree distributions. So if you do measure the AS level internet topology via traceroute or BGP, you get beautiful power law, or you get power laws. You get something that looks like a power law. Okay, and it agrees with the standard paradigm put forward by the three Falutzos in 1999, saying that this is sort of one of the first measurements of the internet having power law degree distributions. And it's been cited thousands of times. I got that number about 3 months ago, so it's probably, you know, increased by 20% by now at least. And these two views really agree very well with the power law degree distributions, but the who is data doesn't fit the power law degree distribution. And the first two views were established via traceroute sampling, and there was some really nice work done recently by Aaron Classe, in fact, sitting over there, and Demetrius Ekliotis, and David Kempe, who was here yesterday, and Chris Moore. And the first work was actually experimental work done by a group, I believe that most of them are at Boston University. And they looked at traceroute sampling experimentally. So they looked at sending packets on a 2D grid on a lattice, and they showed that the act of sampling in this way can make your degree distribution look like a power law. So it's a 2D lattice, a regular lattice, and it ends up looking like it has a power law degree distribution. So you choose a source and a destination pair, and you let the packet wander around on the lattice, and there's so many paths when it leaves its source and so few paths when it gets to its destination that it ends up looking like each node has a power law degree distribution. So they did this experimentally, and then this group showed theoretically that it was true, that doing traceroute on a lattice makes you look like you have a power law degree distribution.
Sorry, on a lattice, the number of degrees that a node can have is 1, 2, 3, or 4. So what do you mean by a power
law? So it makes it look, so if you do traceroute, so you look at how many times a packet hops into a particular lattice site, it makes that lattice site look like it has a degree, a high connectivity.
What she's saying is that the trace, it calls all the traceroute data into question. Because obviously it doesn't.
Yeah, obviously it can't have a degree distribution that's a power law, but the act of sampling in this manner makes it look. So you look at how many times was this particular node visited, and it makes it look like it has a very high degree. So doing traceroute on a lattice makes it look like it has a power law degree distribution. So it has, this recent work has sort of brought into question whether traceroute is a valid way of extracting the internet topology at the AS level. And there was some interesting work that was done recently where they showed that you could heuristically, that you could distinguish heavy tail degree distributions from simple exponentials, but you can't get the precise form. And it also depends on the betweenness of the graph, so the higher the level of betweenness, the better, and how many probes you're using. So traceroute, you start packets at random initial sources, and it goes to random destinations. And depending how many of these different locations you start your sources from, and the betweenness of the graph, you can distinguish between heavy-tailed and simple exponential using traceroute, but you still can't get the precise form of the distribution. So both of those views that are standard, traceroute and BGP, were used traceroute like sampling to establish the AS level topology. And they've been shown that you can't really trust them. So in this paper, they say that this BGP data was gathered by traceroute like probes. Okay. So they, in the paper, I read it carefully many times, and they said that. Okay. So I need to talk to you and understand this better. So the third view is gathered from these network providers, and in this paper they say how it's not a power law and they don't give any explanation. So we looked at the data and it really looks so much like these like a power law with an exponential tail. So this is the actual data of gathered from the WHOIS construction of the AS level internet topology. And then this is the fit from our two parameter model with A1, the fertility rate the fertility threshold 187 and the saturation rate of 90, and we get a really nice fit to this data. So not that we're saying we understand how this grew, but that it's possible. So, and these are just comparing graphs generated by our process to preferential attachment graphs. And you can see they're obviously much more compact, and you can also see effects of aging. So what I did was I used the same number of nodes, and I colored the nodes by their arrival time. So the first quarter of the nodes are blue, the next ones are green, then are red, and then finally orange. And here you can see that there are very few of the newest nodes that connect to the root, but in the preferential attachment, there's no aging, so a lot of the new nodes connect to the root. And you can also look at a whole range of graphs that were generated by our process. So I just pulled out some examples. And of course you can do that because we show that you can get random attachment, you can get normal preferential attachment, you can get preferential attachment with a cutoff. So we can get a complete range of different looking graphs from this model. And it's also actually very numerically efficient. So this is one of the interesting things, is that most optimization models, you have to explore all possible alternatives before you can find the global minimum, and ours ends up being this local model. So all you have to know is the node next to you in space and the parent of that node and how many intervening nodes there are between you and your parent. So you really don't need very much more information than a typical preferential attachment process. So, so because of this locality, it makes it very numerically efficient to simulate as well. So unlike most optimization models, we can simulate this in linear time. So we're thinking about different extensions. This was looking at.
Does your model always generate the tree?
It does right now, so everybody connects to one parent node. But a way to extend it in the future might be to allow nodes to connect to multiple parents, so make end links just like the Barabashi-Albert model, especially once we put it in that preferential attachment framework. So you can then have some randomness in the process. So so we were interested in this interval process because it sort of sounded like the AS level topology. And it's interesting to think if there are different cost functions and geometries that would also give rise to preferential attachment from optimization. So in biology, perhaps there is a need to be modular so that things evolve very quickly. And if some part of the system dies, it doesn't take down everyone else. But there's a tension between modularity and efficiency. The more modular, the less efficient. So we're wondering if these are trade-offs that might work well in a biological setting. In economics, there could be examples about trading with people of equal size as you that could give rise to the same kind of power laws with exponential tails you see in trading relationships. We're really interested in the fine structure of these graphs. And obviously, I have this slide, this comment about validation. So something that we really have been grappling with in the last couple of days is, again, we have a model that we haven't validated in any way. So that would be something interesting to think about. And I just want to switch gears too for a second, because I think one of the interesting things is thinking about hierarchy and feedback. So, you know, we know that these networks have a lot of hierarchy in them, and we're interested in optimization and growth of hierarchy. And I think feedback is one of the things that has been missing from a lot of these models. And so some work that I'm doing right now is trying to put feedback into the network growth process. And it actually ties into thinking about dynamics on dynamic graphs. Okay, so this is actually work that I did several years ago with Sharad Ramanathan and Duncan Temple Lang, and we were at Bell Labs at the time. And we were really interested in the context of sensor networks. So we were thinking about self-organizing sensor networks. And we wanted to think about looking at information flow on a sensor network. So how long does it take for a packet to traverse the sensor network? And if the sensors are going to be mobile, can we get the packet to move more quickly than the sensors move? So we're interested in thinking about separation of timescales, and I'm going to tell you how we came up with a cute argument. Okay, so we're just going to think about sensors getting thrown down at random, and they start communicating with each other, and we're interested in different algorithms for building up a connected network. And we want to know, can we ever do any routing? So is there a regime where we can do routing efficiently? So if you think of these red pluses as being sensors, and they can be mobile, and they can move around, is there any time that the network topology is going to be essentially static so that we can do routing? Or is it impossible? So the nodes move too fast for us to make use of the instantaneous topology. So what we wanted to think about was a random walk in the instantaneous topology. So we just thought about a random walker moving on this realization of the graph that we had at that instant in time. Okay, and here we wanted to think about different communication models. Because if you think of your random walker as being able to flow equally to anyone who it's connected to, that's perfectly fine, but we really were thinking about a wireless channel, so a unicast kind of communication model where you can only have one conversation at a time. So if you're connected to k other people, so if you have k neighbors, you only get to send a packet 1/k at a time, because the rest of the time your neighbors are talking and they're using up the channel. So this would be our probabilities for our random walker. With k-1/k rate, you stay where you were, and then with probability 1/k, you flow to any of your connected neighbors with equal probability. So these are going to be the transition probabilities of the random walk. Okay, you can choose other models, and what follows holds for any other communication model. But essentially, we're thinking about this on the instantaneous graph, and we build the resulting state transition matrix. So we thought about that random walker with that communication model, and we built the state transition matrix, and it's column normalized. So we'll have a principal eigenvalue that's 1. All the remaining eigenvalues will be less than 1. And if you think about applying that state transition matrix to an eigenvector, you get the eigenvalue back times the eigenvector, simple linear algebra. So you apply it t times, you get the eigenvalue to the t-th power times the eigenvector. And we were interested in looking at the relaxation time. So how long does it take before the amplitude of this eigenvector decays by a factor of 1/E?
So what is m?
M is the state transition matrix. So we looked at this random walker, and we use those probabilities on the graph. So M is the state transition matrix for that.
Isn't this a very inefficient way of
separating the network from the energy point of view? Because each time I speak with somebody, I spend the same energy, so I need to speak to everybody. So
yeah, but that's how wireless communication works.
Wow.
So there's handshake protocols. So the sensors can only have one communication at a time unless they can get the attention of multiple sensors. So it's a random decentralized process. You want everyone to decide to initiate a conversation, and they try until they get success that their channel is open. So it's really about decentralized control.
Yeah, it's not the only way you can
connect it. Okay, so that's definitely, but you know, I want to think of this for separation of timescales more than anything. Okay, so if you look at how long it takes for that eigenvalue to decay, you can, take that corresponding time, so we just took the log of both sides to get the time. The longest relaxation time in the system is going to be a function of the second eigenvector, the penultimate eigenvector, the one closest to 1. So this is the longest relaxation time. So we're taking that as a proxy for how long it takes for information to flow on the network. So this was our... So
the penultimate eigenvalue.
Thank you. Okay. So we're going to take this as a proxy to estimate the characteristic time for information to flow on the network. Okay, and t is going to be the time it takes for a sensor to move far away enough that it changes the topology of the network. So if this time for information flow is much, much less than the characteristic time in which the topology changes, we can treat the network as static in the time it takes for the packet to flow, and we can do routing. So we can learn the topology, we can do a lot of useful routing. If we're in this other regime, where the information flow time is of the same size as the time scale that the topology changes, any information we learn about the network is immediately obsolete. So if we're learning about the network from this random walk and where it's visited, as soon as we learn anything, the topology changes and we can't make any use. So we can just do flooding protocols. So we're interested in thinking about separation of time scales. When can you do routing, when can you not? And using this idea from spectral graph theory as an estimate for information flow time. And this was actually what we proposed, was to use this as a performance metric. There are many different protocols and algorithms for building up connectivity in a sensor network, and how do you decide which one's a better protocol and which one's a worse? And there's some simple ideas from percolation, which is the Penrose random graph. And if you look at just a simple idea of using everyone having the same uniform circle, you get these kinds of timescales for relaxation. And we were looking at a local model where our timescales for information flow were orders of magnitude smaller than sort of the simplest approach. So this was our paper in 2003. We said that we could use this as a performance metric for evaluating different construction algorithms. So you want to build sensor networks that have short information flow times so that the end-to-end delay is small and packets get there quickly. So we're trying to use this idea to now think about network growth with feedback. So we've come up with a really simple model and have some very preliminary results. But you can think of lambda as being the rate of node arrival. Okay, and what we're going to say is that you don't get to see every node in the network. You only get to see some fraction of the nodes. So some fraction C of the nodes are allocated to growth, but the rest of the nodes are doing other things. They're doing the function of the network. So the network's not just sitting there waiting for new nodes to arrive so it can decide where to stick them. You only get some fraction of them that are set for that growth. So you get to, when you arrive, you get to evaluate a range of k possible parents, which is the ceiling. It's the integer of the fraction times the number of nodes present. And it all has to be shared by each node that arrives. So you get to see k nodes, which is the fraction of the network available divided by how many new nodes are arriving at that time. And we're interested in an optimization function. I just went through optimization functions in the first half. And we're interested in understanding the fitness of the network, and we're going to use this characteristic timescale for information flow as the fitness of a network. So the shorter the information flow time, the more fit you are. And this is where feedback's going to come in. So we look at how the network is evolving in time and evaluate it every few delta time steps. And we're going to look at the fitness of the graph at time t and compare it to the fitness that it had at an earlier time step. Okay, and if it's equal fitness, then our rate stays the same. If the fitness has increased, our rate increases. If the fitness has gone down, our rate goes down. And since this is actually kind of tied into the range, because the more nodes that arrive at once, the less optimal the position it's going to gain in the network. So as when there are fewer nodes, you get to see more potential parents, so you get a better optimization function. But when you're more fit, you get more nodes arriving. So they're sort of competing forces. And we have some preliminary results just showing that with feedback, we can grow larger, more fit networks in less time. So we're looking at different, this is with no feedback, so the delay goes to infinity. And these are with different kinds of feedback. And we were looking at the size of networks that we grew, how long it took to get there, and looking at this relaxation time as a way to characterize it. So we've been interested in trying to think of how to build the simplest model that we can come up with that will let us incorporate feedback into this network growth process. And using this information timescale as our performance metric to really decide what is fitness and what isn't. So those are preliminary results that we have right now. And we're trying to understand if this optimization function is important at all. So if fitness is the only thing, then we should start from different optimization functions and converge to the same ultimate asymptotic structures. So we're trying to understand really how important is it to have fitness as long as you're willing to choose optimization carefully, as long as you're willing to have feedback and evaluate it. So we're playing around with that, and I'd really love to get ideas from people about what we should do with this model. And so in summary, I would really like people to start thinking more about how to use these ideas for markup chains, like mixing times, cover times, relaxation times, as performance metrics for graphs, especially thinking in the dynamic context. So when can we have separation of timescales? So when can we treat a dynamic graph as static? So we know on the worldwide, on the internet, as Filippo was showing us, we had these dynamics going on of searching, and the web is static during the course of the search. So you have a clear separation of timescales, but can we come up with some metrics that tell us when we have separation of timescales and when we don't? And I think that it would be nice to understand how to do that with some ideas from markup theory. And then I talked a lot about optimization and network growth. So just to summarize this first model, tempered preferential attachment, we start from an underlying optimization framework, and it gives us a mechanism for how preferential attachment can arise, and it also gives a mechanism for aging and saturation, and it introduces this notion of viability. And these are the technical interesting things about it. We get a degree distribution that's a power law with an exponential tail. We get exponents between 1 and 3. We can continuously interpolate from these different models, uniformed preferential attachment with a cutoff to full preferential attachment, and it's really numerically efficient. So we're proposing this as a new class of models for analysis and simulation of networks, just a place to start thinking about more complicated networks, especially with this idea of viability, that we can have different heterogeneity of nodes. Okay. Thank you.